Hello, this is Gideon Rossi, and this is a response a day for the 20th of Tishrei, which is the sixth day of Sukkot. So it's either the fifth day of Chol HaMoed if you're in Eretz Yisrael, or it's the fourth day of Chol HaMoed if you're outside of Eretz Yisrael. And it happens to be, I pointed out yesterday that I have difficulty finding things written on Chol HaMoed for today. I did find something very brief, but I can hope to make a little bit more of it. It's two very brief things for the 20th of Tishrei. The first of them is a historical document, and I started this series hoping not to, or planning not to, impose any of my own interests on the series, and I think I haven't done that. And even so, I find myself coming back to certain topics over and over again. I hope that's because they keep coming up, not because I'm just grabbing them whenever I have a opportunity to find them. But one of those topics is the question of the Heter Mechira. And the Heter Mechira today is like a Zionist, non-Zionist kind of thing. And it was kind of that way back when as well. But Heter Mechira is the question of when Shemitah comes along. It would seem that Torah law, although it would seem that it's a question of rabbinic law rather than Torah law, depending on how you understand the halachic status of the land of Israel today, but it would seem that either Torah law or rabbinic law requires us every 7 years to leave the land fallow, to not work the land, and then also to let anybody take the crops who wants to, and that can create an economic problem for farmers who make their living off of agriculture. It might be one thing when everybody makes their living that way. It might be a different thing when it's a small group of people. Today, it's a whole question because the farming industry, the agriculture in Israel, is an important industry, but it's not the backbone of the Israeli economy. And then every 7 years, the question comes up how to deal with it. And Rav Kook is very well known for, in the early 1900s, I think, for supporting the Heter Mechira in the face of opposition. But what maybe is somewhat less known is that originally, the Heter Mechira came with somewhat better halachic lineage. Better is the wrong word. Rav Kook is certainly a valid halachic lineage person. I think that in the early 1900s, when he supported the Heter Mechira, he was suspect because it was seemed to be so connected to his dedication to building the Yeshuva of Eretz Yisrael, the settlement of the land of Israel, and he was living there. And I think therefore there were those who claimed that you know, the Ahava Mekalkelet HaTashura, that his love for the land of Israel and for the settlement of the land of Israel was in some way getting away of his halachic judgment. So it therefore was interesting to me to come across what I'd always known was out there, but was a letter, and then we'll follow up some of the other letters, by Rav Yitzchok Yochanan Spector. So Rav Yitzchok Yochanan Spector lived outside of Eretz Yisrael his whole life. He was the Rav of Kovna for a long time. And in Shut Rabbi Yitzchok Yochanan, which is one of his books of responsa, they have letters. So the 12th letter has an introduction to it. And the introduction to the 12th letter is that it's a letter that was written to somebody named Rav Naftali Hertalevi, who was the Av Beis Din of Yafo. He was an important Rav in Yafo. And the letter, there's a note here, I think from the editors of the volume of Shut Rabbi Yitzchok Yochanan, was that the letter was originally published in a book called Hora'at Sha'ah, by Rav Yosef Tzvi Halevi, who was the son-in-law of this Rav Naftali Hertz of Yafo. And there's going to be a Shemitah in Tov Resh Nunvav. So the year 1895 to 96 is a Shemitah year. And that year, they wanted to know what they could do about the Heter Mechira. And it's important to remember, I think, that in 1895, 1896, when we're talking about farmers, we're not talking about millions for sure. We're not talking about tens of thousands. We're talking about a few thousand Jews live in the land of Israel at this time. And some of them are just starting to try to build farms. And it's not like these farms are wildly successful. These people are really struggling, and they're making do, and they're trying to make a go of their farm. So this Rav Naftali Hertz, the Av Beis Din of Yafo, wanted to find, this is the introduction to the letter in Shut Rabbi Yitzchok Yochanan. And you know what? Let me pause, because I forgot to thank Rabbi Jacob Bramwitz and David Hachaz and the OU for putting these shiurim online. So I want to make sure to do that. And now we can go on. This Rav Naftali Hertz wanted to do even better than the last Heter Mechira. We're going to get in the letters, we'll talk about what the last Heter Mechira was. We'll get to it, so we'll see it in a second. But he wanted to do better. What was even better? He thought that he would find a way to permit certain kinds of ways of working in the land that the Heter Mechira hadn't included. I think lay people today, it could be that there are even farmers today who think so, assume that the Heter Mechira means you can do whatever you want. But that was not the way the Heter Mechira was originally expressed, that you could work the land however you want because it's now non-Jewish land. It was limited. And he is looking for better ways, and therefore, or broader ways. So his suggestion was, sell the trees of Israel to a non-Jew, al minat yishikutseim hanochri, on the condition that the non-Jew will cut them down. And I'm pretty sure what that meant was, and then when the non-Jew doesn't, it's not our problem, it's his problem. Then the working that land and working that tree and helping that tree grow is not our issue because it's completely his thing. And therefore, if Jews get hired, or however you'd work out the legal fiction, but if Jews technically are getting hired to work his tree, it's not their problem, because as far as they're concerned, that they didn't go. A place that comes up to my mind that we have a thing like this is that one of the solutions for traveling on a boat on Shabbos is to make a condition with the non-Jewish captain of the boat that he'll stop for Shabbos. Then when he doesn't stop for Shabbos, not our problem. We made the condition that he should. I think it's something like that, that sometimes when you make a condition in a sale, even though it's clearly a legal fiction, but you make the condition, that can have halakhic ramifications anyway, and that's what the suggestion was here. That's what his idea of Naftali Hertz. His son-in-law writes that the idea was accepted, was it seemed good to the rabbis of Jerusalem of the time, including at the head of them, Rabbi Yeshua ben Lev Diskin, and a very important Rav of the time, and they all agreed. And in that unified agreement, they wrote a letter to Rabbi Yisrael Hanan of Kovna. Now, it's such an interesting letter. The letter says, Shebal yore'ot hore'ot be'artzenu ha'kidosha, ya'an shekulam maskimim kehore'at ha'abed din di'akva. That he, Rabbi Yisrael Chanan, off there in Kovna, in Eastern Europe, shouldn't issue any more rulings regarding Eretz Yisrael, since the rabbis of Eretz Yisrael all agree with this idea. So, this is before Rav Kook comes along. This is Rav Kook is not yet made Aliyah. He's not yet moved to Israel. This is before that. The rabbis of Eretz Israel are standing up and saying to this important Rav from Eastern Europe, don't get involved. We think that this heter is allowed, and therefore we do. So, and then this Rav Yosef Tzvi Halevi, who's the son-in-law of the Rav Naftali Hertz, who came up with the idea, says his father-in-law also wrote a private personal letter asking Rav Yitzchak Elchanan not to get involved, saying that where Rav Yehoshua Leib Diskin is a Rav, he's an important Rav himself, that Rav Yisrael Chanan shouldn't get involved. And Rav Yisrael Chanan refused. This is the introduction to the letters in the book of Shut, of Responsa, of Rav Yisrael Chanan. It says, Rav Yisrael Chanan lo sam alibo, didn't pay attention to all of this. And he answered too, Rav Naftali Hertz. And then Rav Yosef Yalevi, the son-in-law, and in practice, in fact, all the people in the Moshavot, in the settlements in Israel, followed this idea. They sold their trees to a non-Jew, Almanat Lakutz, and they sold it with the land of the amount that would feed the tree, that would support the tree. And they followed, in other words, they followed this psak, and they ignored Rav Yitzchak's psak. So that letter, as it happens, which is Miktav Yud Bet in the book, letter 12 in the book, it's fairly brief. It's written for Yudiv Tzalharetz with all the nice flowery language that I always skip, but is in most of these Tshuvot. He's like, I got your letter that he asked me about the Shemitah, and I want to just tell you that I have nothing new to say about this issue, in the same way that way back in Tav Resh Mem Chet in 1888, that's what I hold today, below Shum Hin Kachu, without anything new to it, and Hashem should help us, whatever. So I want to look into those letters as well. So there's the previous letters in this book, and Shuri Sukhonon have some of the ideas of what he had. But all I'm pointing out is the background here is that whatever it was he said in 1888, which was good for its time, is what they were looking for, was not seen as perfectly sufficient going forward. And the Rebbeinu of Eretz Yisrael thought they had come up with an idea, and even a great Rebbe like Rabbi Yehoshua ben Leib Diskin had agreed to whatever this new idea was, to this new idea of selling the trees al menat lakutz, and Rabbi Yisrael Chanan refused to go along. So in Shuri Yisrael Chanan Mechtav Yud Nal, so this is Yud Bet that we just looked at. And that was dated the 20th of Tishrei. That's what gave us the end to discussing it right now. And Mechtav Yud, in letter 10, and then we'll get to 11 in a second, which were from a few months earlier. We're up to 20th of Tishrei of Tav Resh Nun Vav. We've already started the Shemitah year of Tav Resh Nun Vav. But the fact is that back in Sivan, right, there's the Shavuos time, so it's like 3-4 months earlier. It's almost exactly 4 months earlier. The 21st of Sivan, Rabbi Zichron was approached by two different organizations. One is the organization called Chovevei Tzion. He was approached by an Aleph Greenberg in Odessa. So he was the head of the Central Committee of Chovevei Tzion. Chovevei Tzion was a group that had been founded by Leo Pinsker according to the notes in the book of Shiva Yitzchak, Leo Pinsker, one of the early Zionists, had created Chov Veitzion to, I think, support Aliyah and moving to Israel and caring about Israel and spreading the idea that people should move to Israel. So they had started moving people to Israel. They have the concern for those farmers there. And they're still connected enough to religion. They care about what does the rabbi say. So this Greenberg had turned to Yitzchak to find out. So the letter is to in advance of the Shemitah Tov Resh Nun Vav. Yitzchak says, back then, we made it very clear that that was a one-time deal, that the permissibility of selling the land of Israel to non-Jews and using that to help allow working the land was a one-time thing of Tov Resh Mem Chet for the Shemitah of Tov Resh Mem Tet of 1889. But now, when the Shemitah of Tov Resh Nun Vav is coming, they come back, the people, so the, I mean, still the notes, not the letter yet. The people representing Baron Rothschild, who was very supportive of the settlement of the land of Israel. We'll get to that letter in a second. And Chov Veitzion, that's our letter. They turned against Yitzchak Ochanan. So on the 21st of Sivan, of Tov Resh Nun Hei, so this is 4 months earlier, he says, you know, I want to know about what can we do for our brethren, Shehit Yashivu Alamat Kodesh, who have gone back to the Holy Land and are settling there. So I want to let you know that already back in Tov Resh Memchet, I had said it was okay. With other Rabbanim going, this idea that Rabbi Yitzchak Ochanan Spector wanted other people involved, and it comes up here, it comes up later, we'll see it again. He was very concerned that he'd not be the lone figure on this issue. He says, because we've seen that there's a matter of Pikuach Nefesh, here are a lot of people, there's a lot of people who would be saved by this, we've agreed to allow it as long as they sell the vineyards, the kremim, the sedot, the fields, and the peyrot, and the fruit, al meshech shtei shanim. So I never realized this until I came across here. The hadam mechira that they allowed was to sell it for 2 years. What are the 2 years? The Shemitah year and the year after the Shemitah year. And I'm pretty sure that's because, and this comes up today for those who don't, it comes up all over the place in Eretz Yisrael because different crops have different growing seasons. So when the Shemitah year starts, throughout that year, there are different crops that are planted, or not planted, but that are growing, and or planted, but that are growing that year, and they don't ripen, they don't come to harvest, they don't come to market, they're not ready to be used as fruit until it ends all throughout almost much of the next year. So that's why they're saying you have to sell it for 2 years, because you have to make sure, I think, that it doesn't belong to the Jews all throughout the Shemitah time for each and every type of crop there is. They also say you have to sell it to the Yishmaelim Adafka, to Arabs. And that's because, and this is a topic that people sort of try to brush under the rug today a lot of times, that's because Yitzchak Ochanan fairly clearly assumed that Christians were Ovdei Avodah Zarah, count as idolaters. I think it's a complicated question today. I think there are sects of Protestant, there are versions of Protestantism that some poskim today, I'm not telling you what my psak is, I'm just saying I think I've heard that there are poskim who would allow that certain versions of the Trinity don't anymore qualify as Avodah Zarah, meaning it's sort of as some Christians have gone further away from what Christianity originally claimed about their Trinity, or the original version was fairly clearly Avodah Zarah, as they moved away from that, so there might be some versions. But back in the 1800s, it was clear that the Christians were of the Avodah Zarah. He doesn't say it explicitly, but I'm pretty sure that's why he says this thing, it go be sold to Arabs, Dafka, specifically to Arabs. And then you have to do it with a real sale, you have to do it with a kinyan kesef of money and a shtar, as we do, for example, when we sell chametz and pesach as well, to make sure that the sale is valid and the sale takes halachic technical validity. And then you can work the land. But he says, and this I'm sure, not sure that people also necessarily follow today. It could be because of later psakim that changed it. But he says it's got to be by the with non-Jews, and then any Torah versions of prohibited work of the land in the Shemitah year. Right? The Torah says you can't, for example, I think, plant. So any Torah requirements that you can't plant the land, if you're going to sell it to the non-Jew, you'd say, oh, but it's not Israel anymore. So he doesn't say that. He says for that you'd still need non-Jews. Then when it comes to Melachot Rabbanan, those aspects of working the land on Shemitah that are prohibited at a rabbinic level, those you can have Jews do, but only on Aniyei Yisrael. So Aniyei Yisrael, that could be that in their time, almost everybody was Aniyei Yisrael, and therefore all the farmers would have done it anyway. But it's a pretty big restriction. His point is, this Heter Mechira in his presentation of it isn't like this blanket thing. You sell Eretz Yisrael, and then you don't have to think about Eretz Yisrael anymore. You can just treat it like any other land. It's you sell Eretz Yisrael, and that helps you such that you can ask non-Jews or have non-Jewish employees or they're theoretically the owners of the land, you can have them work the land in the right, the problematic ways. And then you can have Aniyei Yisrael, not just regular Jews, Aniyei Yisrael, poor Jews, who therefore need a livelihood. And that's another snif latia, that's another element that makes it more mutar. They can work the land in the Rabbanan way. And in this letter, he said, and the distinction between the right and the Rabbanan, go to the rabbis of Jerusalem, they can tell you, the Ashkenazic or the Sephardic rabbis of Jerusalem, they'll tell you. There's not an issue in which Ashkenaz or Sephard matters very much. And then he says, and even though it's true that we only said this heter for the Shemitah of Tafresh Mem Tet of 1889, but in the time since, more Jews have moved to Israel, and therefore, and yet, and then a nice phrase, Uvavonotino Rabim, Od Lotzi Vahashemeta Biracha, because we have not yet merited it, there's not yet a bracha, there's not yet enough economic sustenance that we can make do. That's a question, I think, for today, to think about what it would be the level of economic success you'd have to have in order for us to be able to support the idea of keeping Shemitah its original way. Good question, but not the question here. And then, so since, therefore, even today, meaning even today, 1890, whatever it was, right? Tafresh Nun Hei to Nun Vav, so Tafresh 1895 to 96. Even today, there's still an issue of Pikuach Nefesh for the poor people who don't have any money, and God forbid they may die of starvation. So therefore, I agree that it's still a necessity, and therefore the heter can apply to another Shnat HaShemitah, Tafresh Nun Vav, Valim Tova. And that's what I'm going to tell you, that I think it's true. And then again, he says, but it's only for this year. So that becomes, it has become by our time the kind of thing where it's unfortunately very much of a fiction. You each time say it's only for this year, because this year we see that it's still a problem, but to the extent that it keeps going, never changes, then you never know what would be enough of a situation where you would say, no, it's not a problem. And it's no longer a problem, therefore we don't have the Hetzer Mechir anymore. Hard questions. But that's the letter he sent to the head of the committee of the Chovevei Tzion, and telling them, so this time around, we'll see in a second, that when it was the original Heter Mechira of 1888 to 89, he was very careful not to do it on his own. Here it seems like the extension to another year, he felt more comfortable saying, without looking, he doesn't explicitly look to other people to support it, it seems to me. And the next letter in the book, which is letter Yud Aleph, so just to point out, I started with letter Yud Bet because that was the one dated on the 20th of Tishrei, and today is the responsive day for the 20th of Tishrei. That was the letter of Yud Bet. Yud was the letter to, then I went back to the letters, so the Yud was the letter to the head of the committee of Chovevei Tzion. On that same day, letter Yud Aleph was to a man named Eliyahu Scheid in Paris, and the editor says that this Eliyahu Scheid was the man whom Baron Rothschild had assigned to oversee his investments and the cause that he was supporting in Eretz Israel. Much of the early settlement of Israel in the late 1800s was supported by Baron Rothschild, and that's why he's recognized as being such a great benefactor of the Jewish people at the time. So this Baron Rothschild had assigned this guy, Eliyahu Scheid, and he had turned to Rav Yitzchak Chanan about the coming Shemitah year. And so this letter is much shorter. It's the same day. This is from the 21st of Sivan, the Tafresh Nun Hei in Kovna. And then we don't need to read the letter again because it's pretty much the exact same thing. So he sent out two letters back in 21st of Sivan. Come the 20th of Tishrei, he sent a letter to tell the herd, saying, I've already said what I had to say. I'm not changing my mind. In fact, you have some new idea about what to sell. That's not, I don't care. I don't think it's true. I don't accept it. And then we saw what we saw. What was he said back then? So now, letter 5 in the book, so we've done 10, 11, and 12. Letter 5 in the book was about selling the land in Eretz Israel. And on the 3rd of Adar of Tafresh Mem Chet, the editor tells us, this is back in the previous Shemitah, 3rd of Adar of Tafresh Mem Chet is 1888, the spring of 1888, right before Purim. He had joined into the Hora'ah. Notice, he had joined the Hora'ah, the idea that you could sell Eretz Israel. He had gotten a letter from a Rav Yaakov Bachrach, who had been sent by Rav Shmuel Mohalev. Rav Shmuel Mohalev was the Rav of Bialystok, and he, according to the editor, was like the moving force behind looking for a solution. Rav Yitzchak Chanan was, I think, the great Torah scholar whose authority would really give the imprimatur, the stamp of approval to this, but he was working off of, he was being pushed by, or impressed by, or pressured by Rav Shmuel Mohalev, who very much wanted him to join in. And so this Yeshua Bachrach brought with him a letter that had been signed by Rav Shmuel Mohalev and others we'll see in a second, or I'll just tell you now, I'll look later on, the head of the Beis Din of Kutner, Yeshua, who was the Rav of Kutna, and Shmuel Boilever of Bialystok, and Shmuel Zanvil of Warsaw. And they signed a letter which said, on the condition that Rav Yitzchak Kotnan agrees. So since he knows he's not the only one doing it, then he joined it. Now that's the editor talking, but I think that it's clear because they sent the letter to him already signed on the condition that he'll sign it. To me, that raises interesting questions of Torah leadership, of what you're willing to do. If he's so, and we've seen this, other people will say, I have the Nativ says that sometimes, that we saw also, that or that I've seen, I don't remember if we've seen it yet together. I know I prepared anyway. That I'm signing, but, and I'm saying this, but it's only true, it's only acceptable if other people sign it. So that's the question, as to when you're willing to go off on your own and say, I'm pretty sure, I'm confident enough that this is true, and I'm saying it, or when you require others to join before you're willing to say that it's what your position. Now, the letter itself, the editor says, wasn't originally published. It wasn't made widely available because the people who were looking for the letter, meaning the Rabbanim of Eretz Yisrael of 1888, they wanted a broader heter. They wanted a greater permissibility. Whereas this heter, all it said was that you can sell the land and then non-Jews can work the land on d'oraita ways. And in d'rabbanan ways, I guess poor people can do it. So eventually, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach published it in a sefer called Ma'adani Eretz, which was about Shemitah issues. And he published the letter, as we've seen it, with those things. So this version of the letter from 1888 was, I had always worried about these things, but now when I got the response of these other Rabbanim, so it helped me feel comfortable that I'm not the only person, I'm not the lone wolf. And that question of being a lone wolf is an important halachic issue, because halacha isn't supposed to be set by lone wolves. I should say it that way, too. When I said before, I wonder when people would be willing to go out on a limb on their own, I think that's an important question. But on the other hand, I think it's also important for important people to realize that even though they're great Torah scholars, and sometimes people who aren't great Torah scholars allow themselves to be the ones who are the lone wolves, but Rav Yitzchak Kotnan is a great Torah scholar, so he's saying, even then, I wasn't interested in being a lone wolf, and they're all, though we saw just now that in 1896, when he's asked not to be a lone wolf, when he's told the Rabbanim of Eretz Yisrael have their own solution, and please just stay out of it, he says, nope, I'm getting involved. I'm not, although by then, now we know, by then he had 4 months beforehand already sent out his letters saying what he was willing to do, and now they want to have a new idea, and he did not want to join them in the new idea. So those are some of the issues of the Heter Mechira that came up in the 1880s and the 1890s about how to find ways to let Jews support themselves and continue working the land even though the Shemitah year is coming, and how you do or don't get around those issues. That doesn't quite take up all our time, and they're mostly of historical interest rather than halachic, because there's not a halachic content to that question. So let me share with you also a response of Rav Chaim David Halevi from Shu'at Asei L'Charav, Volume 6, Number 100. So the question came, and this one is dated, actually. We've noted other times that Rav Chaim David Halevi very often doesn't date his idea, his responsa. He dates the letter. He just responds by saying, I got your letter of such and such date. In this particular instance, he gives the year too. He says, I got your letter from the 20th of Tishrei of Tufshim Memhe. That's from 1984. The 20th of Tishrei, 1984. Sukkot, 1984. I got it, but only for some reason I got it now. So he doesn't tell us when now is, but it's clearly much, much later. So I'm coming to answer you. So he answers one question that I didn't think was worth our while. We didn't have the time to discuss here. But the second question, I think, raises an interesting issue. The question was that we always talk about how we would want to get back to the building of the Beit HaMikdash. Right? That's what we want. We're the building of the Beit HaMikdash. And he says, but it's strange because there are commentators, and one example of a commentator is Rashi, who think that the Egel happened before the building of the Mishkan, before the command to build the Mishkan, before Hashem says Parshiyot Truma and Tetzaveh to Moshe Rabbeinu, meaning that the implication of Rashi seems to be that the building of the Mishkan came as to atone and to provide a place for atonement for the sin of the golden calf. That would sound like that without that sin, then there would be no command to build the Beit HaMikdash, and then we wouldn't have had one. Meaning, this person writing the letter says it seems like they're understanding that it was the lack of faith displayed by the ability to worship the Egel so soon after Matan Torah that made it clear that they needed a Beit HaMikdash, if that's true. A Mishkan then, and then later a Beit HaMikdash. If that's true, it would seem like not an ideal. So why are we longing for the return of the Beit HaMikdash? That's the question. I think there are lots of possible answers to that question. I'm not going to get into them because this is not for my platform to talk about what I think. But Rav Chaim David Halevi takes a particular approach. He says, I don't know how you got to the conclusion because the man had said in the letter not only that the Beit HaMikdash wasn't an ideal, but that the Avodat HaMikdash was an ideal, the service of the Mikdash was an ideal. So that part of it sticks in the craw, as it were, of Rav Chaim David HaLevi. I don't know how you got the idea that Avodat HaKodesh wasn't an ideal. There's nobody who thinks of that. There's nobody who says, and they can't think that, because that's clearly not true. Because Avodat HaKodesh means the korbanot, the sacrifices, and those, now, he doesn't get into this, but I'll just point out that that there are places in Nevi'im where the Nevi'im will say, sacrifices aren't as important as you Jewish people are making them out to be. And that's true, and I'm sure he wouldn't have a problem with that, but he's pointing out the other flip side of it. He says, right at the time of Matan Torah, the Jews were told about offering sacrifices when the Jews were still like a bride in the wedding canopy. Right in the end of Parashat Yitro, it says, Mizbach Adama Ta'aseli. I think in Yitro, or Mishpatim. I think in Yitro. Mizbach Adama Ta'aseli, Vazavachta Alav Et Alotaka. You have to make a Mizbach, and you have to offer on it. Yeah, it's at the end of Parashat Yitro. I just checked. Right at the end of Parashat Yitro, Torah says, Mizbach Adama, build me an altar of dirt, whatever that means. Not our topic right now, and offer sacrifice for your sacrifice. So you see that it's important. The end of that phrase, at the end of that passage, is any place that my name is mentioned or I cause my name to be mentioned, I'll come to you and I'll give you a bracha. I'll bless you. So it's clear that korbanot were intended to be part of the picture. That's the answer, in case you were worried about the answer to the question with Nevi'im, is that korbanot were going to be part of the picture, and the Jews, unfortunately, throughout the time of the First Temple, made korbanot much, much larger part of the picture than they were supposed to. But it's clear that it's supposed to be part of the picture. So the part that Rashi was talking about, says Rav Chaim David HaLevi, wasn't the Avodah HaKodesh. It was the Bniyat HaMishkan. It was the fact that there was a tabernacle built in a sanctuary built in the desert. So that wasn't something that was necessarily supposed to happen back then, at that time. And that's what the Chazal say in the Midrash Tanakhuma. The Asuli Mikdash, they say, the parsha was said to Moshe on Yom Kippurim itself. And they say, even though, if you look in the Torah, it actually appears in Parashat Kitisa, the story of the Egel. It's not true. The Egel actually happened before the whole parsha of the Mishkan. So over you, the Baruch Shalom, you find that Yom Kippur, and they got atonement. And that day, Hashem said to Moshe, let them make a mikdash for me, so that everybody will know that the Chet HaEgel is no longer on their account. Meaning, theoretically, if you imagine a world in which everybody understands that Hashem exists, everybody understands Hashem's standards for punishing or thinking well of the Jewish people, you'd see Maaseh HaEgel, you'd see this, they're sitting in the golden calf, you think, oh, the Jews are out, Hashem doesn't care about that anymore. So this Medrash is saying that the building of the Mishkan was to prove and to demonstrate to the nations of the world, it's not true, that if the sin has been forgiven, they're fine. So what would have happened if they hadn't sinned with the Egel? The Chaim David HaLevi says it could be. That would be like it had been in Matan Torah. At the time of Matan Torah, that it could be any place, right? That's the phrase we said before. B'chol ha-makom ha-shereski, any place my name is mentioned. You can build a mizbeach anywhere. You build an altar anywhere. You sacrifice on it anywhere. And that's fine. As was going to be true, by the way, as would be true in all the places until the Mishkan reaches Shiloh, it was true that you could offer sacrifices anywhere. In the desert, you couldn't, but once you got to Eretz Yisrael, until the Mishkan got to Shiloh, you couldn't. And once Shiloh was destroyed, until the Beit HaMikdash was built again, you could offer sacrifices anywhere. So the idea of centralized sacrifice might not have occurred there if you hadn't built the Mishkan. If there hadn't been an Egel, if there hadn't been a sin of the golden calf, there might not have been a building of the Mishkan at that point, and then there might not have been a centralized place for sacrifice until later on. But the sacrifices themselves, says Rav Chaim David HaLevi, those were obviously ritzuyim. Those were obviously part of the proper service of Hashem. He does note that the Sforno gives sort of a negative connotation to that idea of localization. He says, "V'chein ta'asu atem k'deish eshkom to'akom daber imcha l'kabel tefilat v'avodat Yisrael." And Rav Chaim David HaLevi understands that to mean that before the Egel, Jews could pray anywhere or offer sacrifices anywhere, and Hashem would come listen to them. Whereas now, Hashem will only come listen in the Mishkan. So that seems to see the Mishkan as a problematic issue. So he brings that up. It's a long discussion. I can't get into it. And then he says, though, but look at the Ramban in the Hakdama to Sefer Shmot. Now, I'll just throw in, the Ramban in Sefer Shmot makes it seem like he thinks the Mishkan, first of all, he thinks that the command for the Mishkan came before Chet HaEgel. He thinks it came in the original Matan Torah, so he thinks all these problems go away. And he also says, the Ramban says, that he thinks that part of the purpose of the Mishkan was to continue the Sinaitic experience, that the experience of Hashem, the revelation of the divine presence that happened at Sinai, happened in the Mishkan all the time in a much more private way, because only Moshe Rabbeinu was able to access it, but that was part of the point of the Mishkan. In those views, then the Mishkan has its own independent value. So, he says, that's a whole other way of looking at it. He discussed it in other places before. So, Chaim David HaLevi reminds us that when it comes to the Mishkan and Chet HaEgel, the relationship between the two depends on different Mefarshim. Some Mefarshim seem to say that the Mishkan is there to atone for the Chet HaEgel, for the sin of the golden calf. And according to them, you'd have to talk about, and there are various ways you could talk about it, what the role of the Mishkan was and why we think of a Beit HaMikdash as an ideal. If that was an ideal then, that would be one path to look at it. But there are also the other paths to just see it as always having been an ideal of its own, and then the question doesn't arise. So for the 20th of Tishrei, as part of our Chol HaMoed examples of responsa, the main topic was the Heter Mechira and Rav Yitzchak Hornach's role in the Heter Mechira. He's joining that Heter Mechira in the late 1880s for the Shemitah of 1888-89. The limited nature of it, the Rabbanim of Eretz Yisrael looking for a broader Heter, Likrat, in terms of the next Shemitah of 1895-96, and not finding support. Rav Yitzchak Hornach had already sent the letters to various people that he thought the Heter could only continue in the way it originally given it. That limited Heter wasn't good enough for the rabbis of Yerushalayim and Eretz Yisrael, who found another way to do it, and that was what, in fact, the farmers of Eretz Yisrael seemed to have followed in that Shemitah of 1890-596. And then we saw Chaim David HaLevi about the Mishkan and the extent to which it was an ideal and the time that it was built. A responsibility for the 20th of Tishrei. Thank you for joining us, and have a happy Sukkot.